So, here's a question for you, dear listener. What have you been writing this week? Welcome to the Failing Writers Podcast.
Has anyone been writing anything?
Someone will have somewhere, I guess. Yeah.
I can start this by saying I haven't written a thing in the last
week.
I've just been so busy. It's been ridiculous.
It's a good excuse, isn't it?
I can't. I haven't even thought about writing anything.
Goodness me, because that's normally your go-to excuse.
That is my
get-out-of-jail card normally.
Exactly.
Well,
yeah.
I've not been writing anything, but I have been thinking about writing. Oh, well done, Dave.
I have been thinking about the fact that I should be writing something.
Not good, because that just turns into kind of a stress.
That's a bit sad.
It's an unproductive stress. Yeah.
What about you, Tommy? Just give us some good news.
Oh, well, I'll give you some great news.
Oh, yeah.
Well, no, I've over-egged that comedy.
It's going to be massively disappointing.
I shouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
No, I've been thinking, you know, that we were meant to be writing. We are writing. Not meant to be. We are. We're committed to writing a little love story type thing.
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah, I've started writing one of them the other week and then started to finish writing one of them this week and then thought, no, that's rubbish, and then started writing another one. Then realised that the other one I was writing was really rubbish and had no reason to exist. You know, you start writing something and you start reading, you think, there's just no reason for this to exist. There is no story. this couldn't be less interesting.
Just some words.
So I think I've jumped ship back to the original, thinking, well, do you know what? Maybe I'm just not cut out for the love type thing. But
first idea is usually the best one.
You're saying it's not actually a love story?
Well, yeah, it involves love. Okay. That was the brief, wasn't it?
Yes.
It's just, yeah. It's not a typical love story. So I'm going to work on that. I'm going to finish that this week.
Well, they say all no writing is wasted, don't they? They don't say all no rate. They don't say that. They say no writing is wasted.
Yeah, no, maybe.
So that's
maybe
good.
In coming years I'll be writing a novel or something, and I'll have like a section. He goes, and Stephen was trying to write a story, but it was terrible. Here's an extract.
Yeah,
and I can use that other one.
That's cut just as an extract,
just as it is. Won't have to change anything. And people will read that and go,
Tom's got this character nailed.
Wow. How did he write that? Because it really is just like flat and such a cardboard story with very little interest. Amazing stuff. So I'll use that one for that.
Great.
That's good.
What about you, John? John, you been writing?
No, I've done nothing. Not a sausage. No.
Well. Who thought we'd... How many episodes has it taken for me to be the only one that's actually written something in a week? But bloody hell, doesn't it feel good? Hey?
But
you two... Disgraceful.
I feel quite bad.
I did actually.
I saw a quote the other day from Taika Waititi, which made me feel a little bit better. And his quote was, "Sometimes writing is opening up your laptop, looking at a blank page on Final Draft for about 8 hours, and then feeling sad, and then closing it. And that's still classified as writing."
Is it?
So yeah. I'm going with Tiger.
Yeah.
Do you want to change your answer then?
Yeah,
Dave?
In that case, I've written every single day.
Yeah, no, sometimes it is. You've got to give yourself a little bit. I mean, there's a balance, isn't there, between giving yourself a boot up the bum and metaphorically making your bum sore. I mean,
it's true.
There's like saying, oh, I need to give myself a break because, and then there's just making excuses for
doing it. Yeah, you've got to be honest with yourself, really.
It's a fine line.
Yeah.
And I think I've stepped over that line.
But I would still say pull your socks up, boys. Do you know what I mean?
I will.
A bit embarrassing for both of you that I've outwritten you this week.
Well, next week, that will not be the case, because by next week, I'll have written my romance story.
Yeah. Well, we've got to, because we've lined up a guest that is in the romance. What shape is a romance?
Field.
I was going to say crescent, but I don't know why I was giving it a particular shape.
In the romance.
Within the pentagram of... It's not a pentagram, is it? That'd be horror.
No.
That would be wrong, yeah.
Within the dodecahedron of love.
Surely it's a heart-shaped, yeah.
Anyway, yeah, so we're going to get our... Why do we do this to ourselves? So we're going to get some random person that we've never met that we're hoping is nice to judge our stories.
Actually, she does seem really nice.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good. Something.
Yeah.
But
she's going to need to be.
She is going to need to be, because I'm really not happy with mine. And it is terrible. The terrible thing about this podcast, other than all the poor souls that sit through and listen to it, God bless you for sticking with it. But is that we do, normally you do stuff, and then if you're entering in a competition or something, you just go, oh yeah, I'm not going to enter that. Rubbish. Whereas we kind of have to go there.
We like to humiliate ourselves.
This is still rubbish. but I am going to still, I've got to put something forward.
Yeah, we've got to have deadlines at some point in our lives, though, haven't we? So it's good to have a deadline. Yeah. So we need to get those done, don't we, for next week?
We do. We need to get romantic.
Anyway, speaking of prolific writers, we have been lucky enough to get an interview with David Quantick.
Still can't quite believe that this is happening, to be honest.
And it's one of these guys that if the name means something to you, you're like, oh my God, yeah. And then if you don't know who he is, and you kind of go on his Wikipedia and go, bloody hell, is there anything he hasn't written for? And he's done so much stuff. It's absolutely ludicrous.
Yeah.
Mm. Like classic stuff as well, like Brass Eye and The Day to Day and Smack the Pony, gibbering from the sort of the turn of the century, like all the stuff that was really up there was like proper, like the stuff to watch and the cutting edge stuff. And
I tell you what, there's one thing he hasn't done.
What's that?
Properly research this show.
Because he's agreed to come on.
To see if it was worth coming on, because he has actually agreed to be here.
The thick of it, Harry Hill's TV burp. The list is virtually endless. Mitchell and Webb.
And annoyingly, not just that, but he's written novels.
A film. He's just had a film
out.
He's
got a movie out now.
Yeah.
Written loads of articles, newspapers, magazines.
We probably don't need to, we don't need to have him on now, do we? We've just been through everything that he's done.
Oh, and he's, sorry, little thing as well. He won an Emmy. So that's like a little award thing in America.
Yeah. It's not as good as a Scottish BAFTA.
No, obviously.
I think it's like an American BAFTA, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which is like a Scottish BAFTA. Well, I think the American BAFTA claims that it's Scottish or half Scottish.
Yes, yeah. They like a bit of heritage.
Yeah.
Well, should we just talk to him then?
I mean, we could do that. We'd cut out a lot of the in between bit, wouldn't it? If we just sort of waiting.
Yeah. All right then.
Hey, David.
Hello there. All right.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Oh, we're all good. We're all quite hot.
It's quite warm.
That's the same for everybody, yes.
That's the weather chit-chat got out of the way. Well, thank you so much for joining us, David. Really, really appreciate it.
That's all right.
Kind of, since you've said yes, we've become slightly intimidated by your bibliography. We were just running through it before, and it's kind of scary how much involved you were with my formative years of enjoying comedy.
I'm sorry to hear that.
But just the number of different bits from... we were saying before, we just had a quick chat, it was like, well, where do we even start with that? Where do we start?
Don't know. That's up to you, really.
it is. I mean, that's the problem. Where did you start writing for the NME? Is that right? Is that kind of your first writing job?
I started... When I was at university, I wrote a kind of short story, which is a parody of hard-boiled fiction called Love and the Gun, just sent to a magazine called City Limits, and they printed it, and I got 50 quid.
Nice.
But they didn't want any more stories, so I just kept going, did some reviews for them. At the same time, I wrote to the NME, and they got me in to do some reviews, and I stayed doing that. That would be in 1983, but it wasn't until about 1986 that I got the kind of confidence to send comedy stuff, and I sent three sketches to Spitting Image, and they bought one of them. So that was exciting.
Yeah.
Can you remember which one it was?
Yeah. I can't remember the ones that were rejected, but the producer, Jeffrey Perkins, who did a vast amount of stuff, he picked one that was about, there'd been a story about Ronald Reagan, that's how old it is, and something happening in the Philippines. I can't remember what. But the joke was that he had to return all this stuff he'd got from the Filipino government. And the punchline was, but can I keep the manila envelope? Which was the level that I was working at.
Oh, come on, that's good.
That was good. And I had not worked out how to write sketches. So I kept trying to get sketches on. And every so often I would get like a music-related sketch on, because they were, in those days, you know, they were just, even if they were a bit older than you, if they were a bit posh, they didn't know rock music. I've written a U2 parody. It's like, U2, fantastic, jolly good. And who are they? So, you know, I would do pop parodies and things like that. But it didn't really kick in until I started doing a column at the NME with a writer called Stephen Wells, also known as Seething Wells. And we did a column called Culture Vulture or Ride the Lizard. It had many names. And Armando Iannucci read it. He wasn't a rock fan, but we'd written a thing about classical music, just insulting orchestras. And he likes classical music. So he invited us to write on the hour.
Yeah.
And that was it, really. That was sort of the start. And, you know, I still write for Armando. I'm writing on Avenue 5. which starts again in October. So it's extraordinary.
Yeah, that was another one that came on the list. I thought, oh, yeah, I really enjoyed that as well. That was fun.
It's a great, it's the second series I've seen. I've seen the first three episodes of the second series, and it's amazing.
Oh, I look forward to that, because that was really good, really good.
It's horrific. It's horrific comedy.
It kind of started off well, and then just kind of really hit its stride and was just like, I've just got to watch them all back to back. Kind of one.
It is amazing. It's very dark. It's a lot of Armando's shows, what they've got in common is a group of people who are all horrible. You know, that's the thick of it. Even Alan Partridge is especially Alan Partridge. But there's a couple of nice people in Avenue 5, but not many.
And they tend to be victims, don't they? They tend to be not treated particularly well. They don't come out on top by any stretch.
Oh, yeah.
Talking about when you were sort of starting to send sketches around, do you think that there used to be more sort of avenues for sort of aspiring writers to send sketches to people? Or do you think it's pretty much the same as it always used to be?
I don't know, because even at the time, it was just... To be honest, there were, but things were a lot more stratified then. It's like, yes, there were avenues, but they were kind of the same avenues. It's like, oh, Weekending. Fantastic. Weekending was, it's kind of like, I don't know, a Butlins. It's kind of place where you go to once and then establish there's nothing for you there and go somewhere else. You know, it's like, a lot of people started there, but a lot of people ended there.
Yeah.
It was, I don't want to be rude about Weekending, but it wasn't cutting edge comedy. And there was a lot of stuff like that, and you could make, it was always the thing of like, do you want to make, kind of hobby living, writing 30 quid sketches on good shows like News Headlines, and we're talking radio as well.
Yeah.
Or do you, want to write Only Fools and Horses or The Day Today or Seinfeld? Mm. And it was kind of, there was a period when I was working with Jane Busman, and we were working on a pilot for the BBC. And a lot of people have this experience. And we'd write an episode and they'd go, it's not quite right, do it again. And we'd write an episode and we'd get paid every time.
Yeah.
And a lot of people lived like this. Oh, good, $3,000, fantastic, in the bank with that. I'll write another pilot. Mm. Oh, $3,000. And it was depressing.
Yeah.
It's great going to the BBC, TV Centre, having meetings with top people. But you kind of think, I'd rather not have the $3,000 and have a show. Whereas now, because there are no gatekeepers, apart from, the odd sensitivity advisor on YouTube, is wide open, especially with things like Twitter and TikTok.
Yeah,
there are some incredibly funny people out there who I follow online, and I don't know if they monetize their stuff, but I can tell you more about a writer like Molly Goodfellow than I can about somebody who had a Yes, Prime Minister, You Wanted to See Me sketch on Weekending.
It's interesting because we sort of saw about you, it says here that you had something that was claimed as the world's first internet sitcom. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because that seems like an incredibly interesting thing to get involved in right back at the start of it, back in the early 2000s.
It was on the very end of the century, Jane Busman and I had been walking around Soho and we'd just been observing junkies and we thought this would be a fun idea for a sitcom. And oddly, nobody was interested in making
it.
So we made it. We made it with Jess Search, a brilliant producer, a really good director called Ian Denyer. And an astonishing cast, which was Peter Serafinowicz, later of everything, Peter Bainham, later of everything, and Sally Phillips, one of the funniest actors in the world. And Kevin Eldon was in a bit part. It was extraordinary, really good show. And we made it ourselves, cost £5,000. And Channel 4 commissioned us to write a script, paid us £5,000. And, once we'd made it, it's like, what do we do with it? Well, it was like, well, we'll put it on the internet. The internet. And at this point, and Jane kept saying, like, broadband's coming in. And I didn't know what broadband was. And when the Junkies went up, it did have a million hits, but we made the joke that because it was on dial-up, it was the same people trying to download it. It was that extraordinary time when if you wanted to watch a half-hour comedy, you had to take the night off.
Yes.
And it was great, the Junkies. And I do wish it had been made, but it is out there. It is on YouTube. And it was, and we put the pilot on our own website, and that makes it the first ever internet sitcom.
Wow.
No one had done that before. People had done the equivalent of webtoons, 2 minute or 1 minute things, but nobody had done a 30 minute narrative.
And the idea of it was so that you could write some more and it would then be greenlit. Is that the idea? Or was it just to, because you had this idea and you just wanted to do it?
We wanted to make it. It was a good idea. Nobody was interested. Obviously we wanted it taken up as a series because, it had cost £5,000 because nobody got paid, including us. As I say, we made £5,000 off Channel 4, but that paid for us and our insurance and so forth.
Yeah.
So it would have been great if it had been a series, but there we go. I think it's got an Oscar nominee and a Star Wars person in it. So yeah,
it's not terrible, is it? That's really good,
isn't it? Yeah.
It's fair to say you had some later success that probably makes up for that not getting greenlit.
Well, it's still a bit annoying.
It's still right.
Sorry to bring that up.
I mean, I will say that if you go on YouTube and just Google Quantic Busman, the Junkies, it's there. We put it up, I think, last year in decent quality, so it's worth a look.
We'll definitely check that out.
One thing that does come up when you Google your name is the Emmy award-winning for Veep. And I was, because obviously I had so much experience in this country writing and writers' rooms and whatever, or not writers' rooms, depending on how it was run. I assume, were you over in America writing for that? And how different was it?
Well, people do say this a lot. And the answer was that the cast were American.
Yeah.
The crew were American. It was filmed in America. But it was planned in London. You know, it was put together in London. And yeah, you would go out there. But there would always be a couple of writers as kind of caretakers, just to, you know, just to be there on hand to do rewrites and stuff. It was a very unusual. We weren't working with Americans in that sense.
Right, got you.
You know, the directors were often British people like Becky Thomas and Chris Morris.
Yeah.
So it was an odd. It was great working with Americans. They're fantastic, frighteningly professional. And also the actors. I used to say that, you know, when you work in Britain, you might see one of the actors you work with in an advert. When you work in America, you see one of the actors in a movie.
Yeah.
You know, I still like to annoy my wife by watching a film going, oh, there's Tony. Pretending that I was best friends with Tony Hale, for example. But it was, so I think Armando took a British approach.
Right, okay.
You know, the attitude as well. I was told that one reason that Americans wouldn't make a show like Veep was because of the residual respect for the office of the president, bizarrely enough. That's changed.
I don't know if that would have changed or if there was a reason for that changing. Yeah, it might have done. It might have changed, might it?
Not entirely sure, but it was extraordinary, you know, and me and my wife went to the Emmys and that was amazing. We won and I got to shake hands with Mel Brooks on a stage.
Wow.
And the only annoying thing was when I looked around for famous people, the only people I could see were Ricky Gervais and James Corden. It's like, I might as well not bothered coming.
David, is that one of your favourite things to write? Sitcoms, because I know that you write pretty much everything. You articles and comedy skits and radio and novels, bit of everything.
It depends really on the thing. I mean, I really like writing longer things, partly because you only have to have one idea. If you write a novel, you need one idea. If you write a sketch, you need one idea. So you've wasted a whole idea in 30 seconds, whereas a novel or a movie, you can keep it going for an hour and a half or 150 pages. So I really like writing movie scripts.
Yeah.
It's just sort of keeping things in the air, you know, doing different bits here and there, keeping the story going. Also more jokes. And I really like writing novels. Novels are just weird. You write 1,000 words a day and you just keep going.
Right.
So yeah, those are my two favourite things to do.
I've been reading All My Colours.
Oh, right. I wrote that.
Which is quite an apt story for this podcast because it is about a failing writer.
Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah, it made me wonder, are you a Kurt Vonnegut fan? By any chance?
I've heard this. I've only read one. I read Slaughterhouse-Five years ago. I mean, I think he's brilliant. I've just never quite got round to reading him. I probably will, though, because they seem quite short.
Yeah, they are quite short. But yeah, the style of the narrator's got quite a similar feel.
Oh, that's interesting.
And obviously, it's set in America as well, obviously. But yeah, read some, see what you think.
Yeah, I wanted to write. It was actually meant to be like a Stephen King, a Richard Bachman novel, because the plot of All My Colours is quite basic. There's no B-plots in it. There's no change, things just keep getting, and reminded me of a book by Stephen King, Richard Bachman, called Thinner, which has the most basic plot of all time, which is a man is nasty to a gypsy, she curses him to lose weight, and he does. And there's virtually no B plot at all. You just
But a lot of weird shit going on.
I mean, a lot of times my writing advice to people sometimes is pretend to be somebody else because it'll still sound like you, you know.
Right, yeah.
Work for the Beatles when they did Sergeant. Beatles, you know, you do pastiches of people, you write in different styles. No one ever notices. No one's ever said to me, fucking hell, that All My Colour, that's just a Stephen King novel. Yeah.
You've got another novel out imminently.
Yes, I have.
That's Ricky's Hand. Give us the hard sell on that.
Right, well, Ricky's Hand was an idea I had in the 80s. It was one line and I got stuck, and it was basically a man wakes up one day with somebody else's hand on the end of his arm. And I think I got the idea because I had a hangover and I looked in a mirror and my hand was weird. I wondered if it was someone else's. And I had the idea, and I couldn't think of anything else to. I couldn't think of the next bit. And a friend of mine called Mark Sinker said, "You need a next bit." And then I wrote it up as a story for 2000 AD, which they rejected. I'm like, oh, stuff you then. And then I just, it was like, oh, okay, so I'll do it as a novel. So it's basically bloke wakes up. He's called Ricky. He's got someone else's hand. How did it get there? What's he going to do? Who is he? And it just spiraled out of control after that. My then publisher, Kat Camacho at Titan, when I sent it to her, she emailed me back and basically asked if I had mental health issues. I think she was genuinely concerned for me because it is quite, it's a weird book.
It does sound a little sort of John Wagner-esque, though. I can imagine that in the sort of 2000 AD world.
I mean, I decided when I'm writing something like a book, if I've got just the idea, it's always the thing, it's like, well, what is it and where is it?
Yeah.
And because I'd enjoyed all my colours and that had been set near Chicago, which was a place I'd spent some time before, thought, what I'd like to do one set in America. So I've done Chicago, and a place that I like visiting was Florida. I'd spent a bit of time there. Yeah. And it was like, Florida, well, that's Carl Heisen. And once I realised that in every Carl Heisen novel, there's somebody with a deformed limb
right.
who suffers a terrible accident, generally things like a dead dog's head stuck onto the end of their hand. I think that's in one car. It's just like, okay, I'm going to write a Carl Heisen novel, but it's a science fiction Carl Heisen novel. And that was it. And it was just really fun to write because every time you can't think of anything, you just think, what would Carl Heisen do? And that's what I did. So hopefully he won't sue me.
Yeah, crooked fingers crossed, I guess.
Crooked fingers crossed.
You've also got, you've got so much stuff going on. A movie that was out this year, I think it was, Book of Love.
That's right.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, again, that's ideas. I went, had a drink with a translator who I know, and we were talking away about his work, and I just suddenly, and translation's really interesting. I don't know a lot about it, but translation used to be a lot freer, as in people would not quite make things up, but people would just put things in.
Yeah.
They changed the way something was written. Yeah. They changed the emphasis. It was a lot more creative. Because nowadays, you can get into a lot of trouble if you misinterpret people. And I just thought, what if somebody rewrote a book so much it became a new book?
Yeah.
That was like, well, what if somebody had written a boring book and somebody had turned it into a sexy book? And then it was like, oh, what if the person who'd written it was a boring, uptight English man? And if we go the rom-com route, the person who's translated it is the opposite, is a extrovert, sexualized, non-English woman. Then it's like, okay. And that was basic plot of Book of Love.
Yeah.
And that ended up being filmed in Mexico, directed by a brilliant Mexican director called Ana Elaine Callejmayor, with Sam Claflin as the romantic lead and Veronica Echegui as the other romantic lead. I was a bit nervous at first because I said, oh, Sam Claflin. I'm like, what's he been in? He said, oh, he plays Oswald Mosley in Peaky Blinders. I'm like, great, romance. The go-to perfect guy then, obviously. And he's also Moriarty in the Enola Holmes film. But he's great. They're both brilliant in it.
Yeah.
So yeah, I wrote a rom-com.
Yeah.
Which was a surprise, but great, because so I love...
Did you expect to write a rom-com, or was it just the idea just kind of...
Generally with the stuff I try and do, have the idea and then think of the format, which is nice. But I had always wanted to write a screwball comedy, which this isn't quite.
Yeah.
It's more rom than com. But I absolutely love 1930s and 40s American comedies. They're just the high point of Western art to me.
Mm.
Anything with Cary Grant in is just beyond brilliant. So I love that kind of all those things, the meet cute, the sparring, the massive disappointment, the romantic reunion. So yeah, I'm really happy with the way it turned out. And the great thing about doing a film is when you write a book, it's all you.
Yeah.
You know, if it sags in the middle, it's all you. If it perks up. Whereas when you make a film or write a film, the cast just expand, take it into another dimension, and the direction, you know, that adds the romance, it adds the humanity.
Mm.
So that was a really enjoyable and exciting project.
Yeah, and how did you manage to get that commissioned? Because I know that can be, even for well-known writers, it can be an incredibly painful and difficult thing to happen.
Well, the thing with films is it's not really a commissioning thing. I work with a really great producer called Mike Knowles, who's made a lot of indie movies. And basically, he just goes out and finds people who want to invest in films. And sometimes they're individuals, but generally they're companies. This one had Sky involved, Amazon were involved, BuzzFeed, I think it's their first project.
Oh, okay.
And they all bring different things to it. And, you know, once you've got those people on board, of course, you've got outlets.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the worst thing for British films is you make a film and it just sits on a shelf.
Yeah.
Nobody ever sees it. You know, that happens a lot. So we were incredibly lucky that it went straight out there. It's on in America on Amazon Prime, on in Britain in Sky, and went out in various other countries in cinemas, yeah. Which is really exciting. The idea that, you know, I wrote something that's on, people are going, this isn't very good, in Burma and Uruguay. I think you're going to ruin somebody's evening next to
door. You can ruin evenings in different time zones.
Yeah, that's badly amazing. Dubbed yeah. as well, hopefully.
Hopefully translated correctly as well. Maybe someone will have translated the film and made it better.
But the great thing yeah, about yeah. it is that because a lot of the humour has to be about translation, you couldn't do it with people like speaking English with bad Mexican accents all the time. But yeah, when it was, yeah. you know, when Mexicans were speaking, it was subtitled. And when English people were speaking, it wasn't. Which the brilliant thing was, meant that when it went out in South America, all they did was subtitle the English bits.
Just change the subtitles. And yeah, yeah.
unsubtitled the Spanish bits.
Yeah.
Which I think has been the main reason that it's playing in South America.
Yeah.
People don't have to sit there and read flipping subtitles all night.
That's clever, that. Just massively widened your audience.
Absolutely.
Thanks for listening to the Failing Writers podcast. I can only assume you've got a lot of time on your hands, frankly. But if that's the case, be a love. Leave us a nice little review, won't you?
How often do you have big ideas, David? Do they just land on you?
Well, having ideas is like exercising a muscle.
Yeah.
The basic thing is just go and walk. I have a dog, go and walk the dog. Because for years I used to try really hard. You know, like, oh, sit down, have ideas, talk to people about... Ideas do come from talking yeah. to people. When I was writing things, I used to get cards and whiteboards, and it was just a complete waste of time for me. My example I give a lot is that I was walking the dog once, and I was thinking about Star Wars. I don't really like Star Wars. And for some reason, I was imagining deliberately describing it badly yeah. to someone. It's about a space hairdresser. And he's got a mate who's a cowboy, and his best friend's a pedal bin, and he's had sex with his sister. And I had this sort of monologue in my head, but nothing to do with it. And then I was working on The Thick of It, which was insane. It was the last series, and they brought in some new writers. We were all asked to write a bit, or I was asked to write a bit, in which Malcolm Tucker, Peter Capaldi's character, is trying to persuade Chris Addison's character, Ollie, to enter into a plan. And I just thought, well, what if Ollie was a Star Wars fan? Because that would make sense. Yeah. He's the kind of person who would love Star Wars. And so what if the way that Malcolm tries to persuade Ollie is by using Star Wars as an example? But what if he can't remember the name of the film? Or if he's such a bastard, he's pretending not to. So I wrote this, you know, and they filmed it. And I was at the rehearsal. And that's a high point of my life, seeing Peter Capaldi laugh. And it's one of my favorite moments in world history. It's on YouTube. Where Peter Capaldi, Malcolm Tucker, says to Chris, you know that film you love? And Ollie goes, what film? The one about the space. And I mean, I'm rambling a bit, but that's an example of how, file it away, every idea.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't think of the home for your idea first. Think of the idea and then think, well, there's clearly a yeah. place for this.
It's something that we hear a lot with the people that we've interviewed about, like nothing that you come up with is ever wasted. Just sort of file it away somewhere, you know, one day it might come in useful.
It's true. Just because people just think, oh, I have to do this or that. I suppose one problem is that for a lot of people, you don't always have the freedom to sit down and write up the ideas that you like.
Yeah.
You know, you spend a lot of time chasing other people's ideas, being told, oh, we need this sort of thing, or can you write it for this actor or this age group? Whereas, to be honest, having the idea, you know, if you have the idea, people might go for it.
Yeah. I enjoyed the chapter about where ideas come from in How to Write Everything.
Oh, yes, and you've probably heard most of this interview if you've read that.
Because I think it's such a hard thing to talk about, you know, with any level of intelligibility. I think one of the things you said, one of my favourite little bits, was it was something like, you have to make thoughts... You turn thoughts, I'm paraphrasing really badly, you turn thoughts into magnets or something, and those magnets attract more useful thoughts. And I thought that was a brilliant way of describing that feeling of coming up with ideas, to describe them as magnets and almost like little gravitational, you know, the more you sort of collect them together, the more they kind of bring in other ideas. And I think that's exactly right. You just sometimes need to start with anything and then it'll potentially just start to build.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm right, but sometimes more metaphors. Having ideas is like putting seeds on a bird table. You know, you just put a couple of things down there. Sometimes it's just vaguely just, what are you interested in? And you don't know, you know, it's like when somebody says, what books do you like? Or, you know, it used to be that thing, you'd go into a record shop and you're like, oh, great. And you could never remember all the albums you wanted to buy. It's like that with ideas.
Yeah.
If you force yourself to list them. But if you just sat there one day and you think, oh, I really like murder and vampires. I wrote a script called, I've forgotten it, Vampire Mods versus Zombie Rockers, because I'm really interested in music, and I thought it would be funny to write a vampire and zombies movie. And then you start gluing the two together. It's like, why Vampire Mods? It's like, well, mods are obsessed with looking good, so we're vampires. Mods don't go out during the day, nor do vampires. Mods don't really have sex, nor... And it was just like, well, what about the rockers? Well, rockers are kind of grungy, so are zombies. You know, rockers like death metal, so do zombies. So, yeah, it's juxtaposition, but having ideas is just any... And what I like about it is... All right, the example that I think I give in the book is that Kingsley Amis, very funny man, he sticks his hand out for a cab one day, and as he does so, he notices... An Asian man a bit further up the street has also stuck his hand out. The cab drives right past the Asian guy, picks up Kingsley Amis. Kingsley Amis gets in the cab, and like most people, he doesn't make a thing of it. He just carries on. And he just thought, well, what if I wasn't that person? What if I said, sorry, mate, go back, get that guy. You're a racist.
Yeah.
And then he had a character, and then he wrote a novel. Mm. And it's just the whole thing for me is training your brain to recognize when something is an idea.
Most
of us will just go, oh, there's a fly in my beer. Wouldn't it be funny if alcohol plus fly equaled giant killer robot fly, which most people rightly say, no, it wouldn't be that funny. But, you know, it's just recognizing ideas.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's something in that.
In terms of having ideas throughout, have you ever worked on something that was... I suppose all of it will have been to some extent, but particularly high pressure or quick fire or kind of that sort of challenging, I don't know, writer's room environment? And has that been harder to have ideas?
Well,
are you an under pressure guy, or are you a in my own time, thank you kind of guy?
Well, I like deadlines. I never liked that Douglas Adams thing of like, oh, I love to see deadlines whoosh by. I love, you know, I started off as a music journalist when if you missed a deadline, you didn't get paid. Yeah. You know, you had to, everything had to be ready in time to go to the printers because it was a weekly magazine. And I think, you know, the most intense thing was doing Harry Hill's TV Burp, because while the ideas thing wasn't that bad, it was the thing of watching all the videos and the DVDs.
Finding the bits.
It was watching 5 hours of EastEnders one go, followed by 5 hours of Coronation Street and 5 hours of Emmerdale. So that wasn't pressure as such, it was just slog.
Yeah.
I don't want to call watching telly hard work, but it was...
But there was a pressure, I guess, to see things, wasn't there?
There was a pressure to do it. You're in a room with five other writers, and if they all spot a joke and you don't, you look a bit stupid.
Yeah.
But there's your own competition, you know, because you want to have the best joke.
You're
not at war with the other writers, but it's like you obviously want your joke in the show. And I remember me and another writer spotted the same funny thing. It's in Harry Hill's memoirs. I'm really pleased. We're both watching Emmerdale, and we both saw that for some reason there was a goat at the top window of a house. Never explained.
You can almost hear Harry Hill doing that gag now, can't you?
It's great. And one of the writers came up with something, which was something like tall goat at window. And it was my turn, and I just said window goat, which made Harry laugh. And that's in his autobiography. And I even have a Harry Hill's TV Burp badge that says window goat.
So you bloody should.
Absolutely.
Right.
I mean, sometimes just things are stupid. Window goat is meaningless. It's inaccurate, but it's funny.
Yeah.
I think that
to some extent, Harry Hill's TV Burp is the most, it's almost like pure distilled comedy, isn't it? Without any, didn't have to pretend to be anything else. Or it was just, it felt like there wasn't a lot of boundaries in terms of, like you say, window goat is fine. That's funny.
There were points you'd be watching the show. It's like it starts off, it's meant to be, let's have a look at EastEnders. That was, but by the end, you know, he's running around a plate of sausages being chased by a bus of Queen Victoria with legs. And you kind of think, and it never felt self-indulgent. It never felt disconnected because it always went back to the TV shows. There was always a spine of reality. But it was an insane show. It's definitely one of the funniest things I've ever worked on. And Harry's fantastic.
Yeah,
so,
I think it's brilliant. Like just such pure comedy.
It's great.
I think you tell a lot about things like that as well, where I'm sure agents and money get involved. But often the people that were there being the butt of the joke would willingly come on for the end bit or as a spoof of it as well. It's done in good humour.
Yeah, the show was liked. It was people liked being on TV Burp. You know, I mean, famous people like being on telly anyway. It was great. And what I particularly liked was that often you'd have somebody on and they would only be famous because they'd been in, you know, Picky Eaters or something like that.
Yeah.
Or Homes Under the Hammer. And it was nice to get members of the public, semi-members of the public in, as well as famous people. And I think we got more mileage out of them. It was less exciting to see Amanda Lamb than it was to see somebody who came ninth on Come Dine With Me.
Yeah, you know, there's some truth in that, isn't there? You kind of expect the TV people to be on TV, but the fact that you'd actually got, like you say, literal person off Come Dine With Me, and then you recognise that, is somehow more entertaining, isn't it?
It was more like your tribe, you know, watching your people.
Yeah.
You felt a bit like a member of a very weird gang watching TV.
Speaking of Come Dine With, you were on Come Dine With Me, weren't
you? Yeah, that was weird. There was a brief period in my life.
I'm not just made that up, have I? You were.
I was on Celebrity Come Dine With Me with Ulrika Johnson, Misha Paris, Ben DeLisi and Helen Lederer. I came fifth out of five. It was a very strange experience. And after that, I was offered to be in something like Celebrity Antiques Cash.
That sounds good.
Fido. And whichever it was, the show was, the premise was that you would auction an antique that you owned for charity. And I'm like, I haven't got any antiques, so I'd have to go and buy an antique and get it away. But yeah, it was a really weird time where I was nearly... And you sort of realise that, you know, I'm not a celebrity, and you become a celebrity by being in shows that have the word celebrity in the title.
Yeah, that's true.
But safe in the knowledge that there's half the nation whose telly-watching hobby is to watch things that are called Celebrity XYZ and go, I don't know any of these people. Does anybody know any of these people? I don't know that.
It is weird.
I think they used to be on EastEnders.
It is the only thing that I ever get recognised from, because sometimes they repeat it. You know, I'm sure some people are dead in these shows.
Well, I'm sorry to hear you came fifth. What did you cook?
I don't know. Meat.
Some sort of meat.
That lack of investment is maybe why you came there. Yeah, brilliant. Well, yes, I think that's got to be the pinnacle of your career.
It's pretty much the high point.
Yeah. The irony would have been if then you would have been spotted on Harry Hill's TV Burp as from your appearance on Come Down.
Oh, there was a very meta moment when briefly I did the voice for Coach Trip.
Oh, yeah, another one.
It's just one of those moments you just don't know how this happened. And I don't know how it happened, but I was the voice of Coach Trip for one season, maybe two. And somebody actually brought in a clip of Coach Trip for TV Burp. I don't know if it got used, though, but that was a bit too much.
Hang on, David. You mention in How to Write Everything about this, and I think you say something like, one day I'll tell you about how I got replaced on that show.
Oh, yeah.
Is today that day?
It could be, yeah. I opened my emails one day and found an email which was not addressed to me.
Oh.
It was from the producer of the show, and it was addressed to the producer of another show called Celebrity. And it was interesting to read between the lines, because the email basically said, Dear producer Celebrity, thank you for your email concerning David's availability to appear on. First thing I would like to say is that David is not a celebrity. That said,
hang on, he's been on Come Dine With Me.
The second bit is it went on to say, that said, he is also very bad tempered, and I'm not sure if he'd be a suitable guest. And anyway, he will not be doing this job for very long.
Oh, shit.
So I discovered that I was about to be sacked from the show, and then the producer hated me.
Yeah, wow.
I mean, I'm not saying he was wrong. I was very bad-tempered.
Some justification by the sound of it.
It was a very exciting moment, but I would like to have been on Celebrity, whatever that is.
Right, I've got a joke for you. Did you hear about the people at the party who were queuing for a fruit-based alcoholic drink? Sorry, why aren't you laughing? That was the punchline.
Are you a big fan, David, of what, like, writing with other people? Is that... Because we're currently... Part of this show is that we're trying to write something collaboratively and finding out the sort of difficulties in that. Is it something that you particularly enjoy, or do you prefer to sort of... plough your own furrow?
I like writing on my own more. I like working with people, but no, I like writing on my own, to be honest. Just because I don't know if I've got ADHD, but I'm very impatient. Mm. And I also work very fast. Not as fast as everybody, but faster than a lot of people. And I just like to get on with stuff. You know, it's nice having people. The thing about writing with other people, I have been told, is the best way to do it is to have totally different tasks, totally different role. Have one person who's funny and one person who can do character or story.
Right.
You know, as a miserable person, the problem for me with a lot of British comedy is you often get two men, both called Dan, who sit there and laugh at each other's jokes. And because they're both funny, and it's like, Yeah, you kind of need one of you who's not, you kind of need someone to read the map and someone to drive, not two people to read the map. I may be wrong about this.
Well, that's good, because I'm not very funny, so that works.
If
quite
you're not
well,
funny, that's probably the best way to do it. You want to be a comedy writer.
Because you have written on quite a lot of shows that have had a lot of writers on them, in terms of, you know, talking about Veep and Mitchell and Webb Sound, that sort of thing. So is it just a case of you know, sort of sitting on your own, writing some things, sending them in and seeing what bites?
Well, at my age, a lot of it is a question of being asked to do stuff. And to be honest, I don't really do a lot of telly. I do things for Armando because he's been kind enough to bring me back in on several occasions. But no, I do weird things on telly. I do, not weird, but like National Geographical things. I've written for Will Smith, and I've written for Chris Hemsworth, because there are these shows where famous people go around the world. There's a brilliant one called One Strange Rock, where Will Smith goes around the world and does various exciting science things.
Right.
And I got to do the rewrite of scripts on that.
Wow.
That was extraordinary. Yeah, so it is odd jobs like that, and I'm currently working on a pitch for an animation for somebody. And these are sort of jobs where you don't, having an extra person, having a co-writer doesn't really help, because you just want to get on with it.
Mm.
And I think that if you look for the current model, if you look at shows on Netflix and other channels, you know, the model is often for one writer. Whether that's just one writer getting a credit for stuff, like I did, you know, when I worked on Veep, I would get a credit for an episode that I hadn't written on my own, because everyone collaborates. It's hard to say, but generally a writer is somebody who kind of puts things together at one stage of the process. You know, everyone's going, right, we've got the characters, we've got the plot, we've got the setup, we want this episode, and we want you to write this, and in this episode this happens, and these characters, blah blah blah, and you write it, and it's sort of like, that's another piece of the jigsaw moving on.
So you're not often doing the kind of plotting aspect of it, you're kind of putting it together and making it work.
Yeah, that's right, and it's a lot of it is done for you at the moment. The the animation that I'm working on is an adaptation of a children's book anyway. So while I've been given a lot of freedom, obviously, if I suddenly set the whole thing on the moon instead of in Exeter, that would be something that needed a lot of discussion.
It sounds, from what you said, David, that you're not that you're more of a sort of discovery writer than you are a plotter.
I mean, I've said this in the book, I think, but I go with the Kingsley Amis or Philip Larkin quote. So writing a book, this applies to everything, is like going on a car journey from Land's End to John O'Groats. You know the towns you're going to pass, you're roughly aware of the roads, but lots of stop-offs. And I did try writing things like Graham Greene, who used to write, you know, chapter 6, Scobie meets Thompson, blah, blah, blah. And I'll write a rough outline for what I'm doing, and there will be a degree of plotting, but not chapter by chapter plotting, not scene by scene. And I have done films like that and enjoyed it. But generally with a movie script, I'll write a brief, you know, maybe 2-page synopsis, and with a novel, I'll write something similar. Because I like being, I used to get bored. Again, it's attention span. You're sort of like, if you know what's going to happen down to the minute, it's like, I don't want to write it. But if I write a scene, it's like, I like to sort of have a goal. It's like, right, in 2 chapters or half an hour's time, the hero is going to discover X. How do we get there? And that's the fun bit, is trying to tell myself how we got there. I'm writing a novel at the moment, and it's like, oh, so there's these two characters having a relationship. And then I just had one of those revelation moments. What if their relationship was actually this? It's like, oh, wow. And you think, well, if that surprised me, then it's probably going to surprise somebody reading it.
Could you write a series?
A series of books? Yeah, I mean, maybe one day I will. Had my other books, earlier books, been successful, well, one of them, Night Train, which I really like, I would like to write a sequel to that. And the books I've written for Titan, yeah, they're kind of connected in various ways, but in various subtle ways that nobody would notice. But yeah, I mean, I love the Harry Potter books. I love Ian Banks's culture novels. I love sequential. I love, you know, I'm currently reading the Mick Herron novels, the Slow Horses series, because I like the series on Apple.
Oh, yeah.
And it's,
that was brilliant.
It's a really good, it's a really good show. And interestingly, written by comedy writers, Will Smith and Morwenna Banks and people like that.
Right.
Yeah. No, that was damn near the perfect show, that. It really was amazing.
There's been some great telly at the moment. I really enjoyed The Midwich Cuckoos. I really enjoyed The Lazarus Project. That was, I like ideas. So I do like a lot of science fiction-y things. I like Korean dramas a great deal, because the imagination in those is amazing, and they're funny and emotional and imaginative in a way that a lot of British and American shows aren't. Yeah.
So you've mentioned the animation there, David, in the book. What else have you got coming up in the future?
Well, I don't know. It's what I can get away with, really. But I'm hoping to do another series of the French and Saunders radio show I did. I'm hoping to get one of my novels published, because I've kind of got books in the trunk, as they say, that, you know, takes a few months to write a book, but they only come out once a year. Mm-hmm. So mathematically speaking, you're generally going to have more books than a publisher wants, even if they do want them. Because I'm certainly not at the stage where if I write a book, a publisher goes, hey, you're writing a book. It's more like, I've written a book. Oh, good. Thanks.
Right.
Another one.
Pretty much that kind of thing. But yeah.
So how many projects will you have on at the same time? Because I struggle with a kind of paralysis, because I've always got too much stuff to write.
That is an issue. I don't know how many I've got. Probably about 4 or 5. I kind of have a ladder. So if I'm having a normal day, quite often I'll start with the easiest thing, which might be a record review or a sketch, but, you know, something short, get that done, and then move up. At the moment I'm writing a novel, and I'm writing 1,000 words of that every day, and then moving on to the next thing, which is an idea for a film script somebody wants me to do. And then if something comes in, like the animation thing I've got a deadline for, I will be like, okay, oh, bugger, deadline, and I'll do that.
Yeah.
But the only way to sort things out is to is to put them in a list of things, because everything's an equal priority in your head, and it's all spinning round in orbit, and you get paralysed because you're like, I don't know what to do first.
You do exactly that, yeah.
So the answer is pick. Exactly. Well, it's the same as I said about writing ideas. We have got one. Do something. Pick one. Move it out of the way. Yeah. Do the next.
Good advice. I will try that.
just do something. Don't
stop being a lazy bastard.
Bit of that as well.
David, when you started at the NME, what was it like? Because it was early 80s, wasn't it? What was the scene? What was the vibe? Was it down the pub every lunchtime for 4 hours, or what was it?
It was a strange time, because the NME was coming out of this massive era of world dominance. It had become the cool rock mag in the 70s because of things like Bowie and the Stones and Roxy Music. Then it had pretty much won the punk wars, and, you know, being the voice of punk. And then things have started to diversify again, and people were less interested in rock, and rock music in the early 80s wasn't very exciting. It was the Smiths and REM. And so it was just, when I started there, it was, you know, it's like, oh, I've missed the boat. Lots of brilliant writers, loads of brilliant music, but it wasn't much fun. It was people like Nick Cave, who's great, but, you know, Nick Cave is hardly the Specials in terms of fun. And so it was a bit serious and a bit bleak, and Julie Burchill called it a bit quiet in the library. And it got jolly again later, but, you know, when Acid House came along and Baggy and various things. But I had to wait.
Yeah.
I don't know. I felt like I was in suspended animation. I had to wait for about 5 years before the NME got funny again, which is no disrespect to the people who worked there. It was just the way the music scene was.
I don't know if people, younger people, if you like, might not realise just how big the music press was in the 80s and 90s. It was absolutely huge, wasn't it?
It was the only access. You know, it's like if you wanted to hear a record that wasn't in the charts, you know, either sit up all night listening to John Peel or you'd buy the NME and read a description of it, which is what reviews are. And if you wanted to see a band, you couldn't go online. You had to buy the NME, which would have a list, have a gig guide, a list of, you know, the shows that bands were playing and which bands were coming over. There was no other way to find out. If you wanted to go and see the Smiths, you had to buy a music paper to find out when they were playing and when they had an album out. And, you know, it was very easy for NME writers to believe that people bought the NME for the deathless prose. And sometimes they did. But when the internet came along and you could see, you know, it's like, oh, Interpol have got a single out, they're going on tour. Go on YouTube, watch the video for the song, hear it, buy it online, find out the tour dates in 3 seconds. You know, the NME became almost instantly redundant.
Yeah.
And on that happy note, now I just want to say one more thing. I mentioned that I read How to Write Everything and All My Colours, but I just wanted to say I really enjoyed them. And perhaps more than anything else, I found myself actually very excited about the idea of doing some writing after reading How to Write Everything. It's a very positive book. It makes writing seem like it's doable.
Well, writing is doable. I saw one Amazon review. Amazon reviews are always great. And one of the reviews just said, he keeps just telling me to write stuff.
Yep.
You know, because the world is full of, I always say, self-help books, which are basically books that tell you what to do so you don't have to do it. Yeah. And the whole point of my books about writing are basically don't read the book, just go and do some writing.
Yeah.
So exercise. If you want to get fit, lift things and eat oranges. Don't read a book about it.
It's very much similar message to the fantastic theme tune to the kids' programme, Why Don't You?
That was a great show.
Wasn't it? Why don't you turn off your TV set and do something more useful instead?
Go out and do something. Yeah.
Brilliant. Brilliant theme tune.
And that is exactly the message of my book. Why don't you stop reading this book and go and write something?
It's very much the message of this podcast is don't listen to this podcast and go and write something. And lots of people have done that. Lots of people have done the not listening
people
to this
are not
podcast
listening in their
and writing something instead. So in that sense, it's very successful.
Well, maybe don't say that bit right at the start of the show.
We'll save that for
the end when no one's listening.
That would work for
Great.
Me.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Dave. You've no idea how much we appreciate it.
Not at all. Thank you so much, men. And just let me know when it's on. I look forward to hearing it.
Thanks very much, David.
Cheers, Dave. Have a good one.
Look forward to the book. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Cheers, bye.
Bye.
Genuinely funny man, you know, he didn't have to put any effort. Do you know, he's just funny, yeah, just comes out of him.
He's not, you couldn't say he's trying too hard, could
dry,
you?
Very dry, very dry. Lovely.
What an excellent bloke.
Just, slightly starstruck. I think we said at the start, but.
Yeah, I think we all were a bit there.
Quite a coup, I think, really. If not to keep going on about the stuff that he's done, but he's just done the best things that have ever been on television. So it's quite a coup for us to have him.
I've started remembering all the questions.
Oh, here we go again.
Bloody hell. This is why
we're... He's not still in the green room, is he?
No, he's gone.
This is why we're not going to take over from Parkinson.
Chasing after them down
Imagine
the corridor.
Parkinson,
David!
Yeah. No, come back. Literally, run. I'll give you a pen. Come back.
I wanted to ask him about Chris Morris.
Oh, you shouldn't. That would have been a good question.
Being a big Chris Morris fan.
Perhaps, do you know what? Perhaps we should just ask
Chris Morris on.
Let's get Chris on.
We're hitting the big time now, aren't we? So
many things. I love how he has in his ability is obviously to have an idea, not just have the idea, because anyone can have ideas. Even us three have ideas. But just the ability to follow them, replace them and make them solid, real.
Yeah, it was just that bit, wasn't it, that he kept saying, which really stuck out for me, was the what if thing. Like first recognising when you've got something worth pursuing and then just constantly, what if?
And rather than thinking, oh, that's just a bit rubbish, leave that, just asking him what if.
Yeah.
That's what I need to do to my love story,
Absolutely.
Isn't it? I need a what if. I need to get back into it and go,
that's it.
Well, what if?
And the great thing about that is that it doesn't matter if the answer is crap. Do you know what I mean? You can say, what if they were that? What if they did have gills? And if the answer to that is, well, that would just be ridiculous. You just move on to the next thing. All right, what if they had, something
what
else?
What if they had someone else's hand on their arm?
Exactly.
I mean, come on. What if I had that idea 30 years ago and now I'm doing something with it? I mean, seriously.
Is that an upsetting question to ask? Just the fact that he started so young, does that upset you ever? You think, God, I wish I'd started doing more writing when I was a lot younger. Yeah. Are we starting too late? Do you ever have that thought?
Well, the average age for someone getting their novel published is something like 43.
Is it?
That's good.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
that's quite that's, promising.
That makes us suitably average. Chaps, doesn't it? So
so we're within the we're in the window, but we just need to actually do something about it nowish.
Yeah,
but I think definitely there is that with everything, though, isn't it? It's hindsight, and did you have time, and would you know enough about what you know now and be able to actually write decent stuff? Or
also
it's a really hard equation.
I was very distracted by other things. I'm not sure I could have done a lot of writing.
Yeah.
If I look back on the rest of my life, I was definitely being distracted by other things.
Yeah, absolutely. But now our lives are kind of empty and middle-aged.
now there are huge holes in our lives. Yeah.
We need to fill those with something.
Fill them with words.
And yet someone else that came on and basically his advice was just right.
It's annoying that, isn't it?
You can't avoid it. You can't get out of it.
I'm hearing it. That's why the answer to the question next week, what have you written, has to be
something.
Something.
And that is, I wasn't just blowing smoke up David's arse. I that is my recommendation of the week. What's it called? How to Write Everything. It's very good. In fact, it made me think it's exactly the kind of thing, or even the style of it would probably be very like the sort of thing that we would write. as our failing writer's guide to writing.
Oh, right, okay.
So you guys should definitely read
Perhaps
it.
Perhaps we ought to read it then.
And we can copy it.
Yeah,
we can
totally just rip it off, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Plagiarize it.
No, I'm not suggesting that,
no,
Tom.
No, not that. No,
no, but the rules of copying are, as long as you do it in your own handwriting, it's fine, isn't it?
He sounds a bit like us, if you know what I mean.
There we go. We get
obviously better.
What if we said, what if we did like a little intro and then said, to quote David Quantick, and then just literally put the entire book in and then close the quote marks at the end and went, we would tend to agree with him.
Yeah.
Could you do that?
I think you could do that.
Quoting a, yeah, that'd be all right, wouldn't it?
So, next week. Love stories.
Oh, there's always something else in there. There's always something else to do.
So that means we actually do need to finish our stories so we can send them to be analysed, criticised.
That's a good point.
Which is why we need to hurry up and do them.
All right, well then in honour of David Quantick, we should give ourselves a deadline right here, right now to fit. So what is the deadline for finishing these romantic stories?
I reckon we've got 48 hours, Matt.
48 hours, that's like 4 or 5
what?
Days.
What? Hang on, work is very busy. I might need a bit of weekend time. I might need at least Saturday. Well. Can I have Friday, Saturday as my 48 hours?
Yeah, you pick any 48. Yeah,
so I'm going to have... say which 48 hours, do we?
Yeah.
Exactly.
So, in 2028, early December, there's a 48-hour period.
It's a bank holiday.
Well, I could have 6 hours now, 6 hours tomorrow.
You can't split it up, Dave.
Oh, bloody hell. Let's say Saturday, then.
Dave, unfortunately, has picked a 48 hours from 3 weeks ago, and he's really annoyed he's missed the deadline.
Listen, I think we've got to be fair to ourselves. Let's say that we'll ship them on Monday morning.
Wow, this really is creeping, isn't it? This deadline.
But come on.
Yeah, okay, cool. Monday afternoon, we'll do it.
I just said Monday
afternoon. Monday afternoon, Tuesday morning. Oh, hang
Thoughts
on.
Of prayer Tuesday.
When's this lady supposed to be?
We're talking to her on Wednesday.
Wednesday.
It's got to be Monday. Come on, give her some time to read
I can't
it.
I keep saying this lady. What's her name, John?
She's called Janice.
When's Janice going to actually have the time to read them?
That's what I mean. That's what I mean.
That's what I mean. So we need to send them Monday morning.
Okay.
Perfect.
Hard deadline, Sunday night. For Monday morning.
Tuesday at the absolute latest. Cool. Let's go with it, lads. Yeah. Pressure's on.
Right. See you later, chaps. Get them written.
Thanks for listening, everyone. See you next week.
Hello.
Hello.
Where's everybody gone?